next felonious monk and between the devil and the deep blue sea. That's all we have time for, I'm afraid, on today's show. My name's Daniel Wolf. I will be back with more music on CFRC 101.9 next week at 2 p.m. The name of the show is Dark Glasses. Hope you've enjoyed it, and it's getting cold out there, so if the weather we've had for the last couple of days continues, make sure you keep warm and stay safe.
Keep track of the visions in my eyes while she's deceiving me. It cuts my security as she's in control of me. I turn to her and say, don't you should blame the guy in chains, oh no.
The guy in chains, the guy in chains, oh no.
Don't masquerade with the guy in chains, oh no.
We can't believe it,
cause you got it made with the guy in chains, oh no.
I think maybe I'd be good at this. I hope I don't have to pitch you an idea. I hope that this not depend on me coming up with the killer podcast idea.
We asked for the best. About a year ago, we put out the call. Canada Land wants the best podcast makers to send us their best podcast pitches. And we were overwhelmed by the response. Hundreds of ideas poured in from some of the biggest and best names in the business. We painstakingly turned a giant list into a short list, and then we turned a short list into the shows that we have been launching. Pretendians, Field Guide to Gay Animals, and an upcoming investigation called The Kopernik Affair. We asked for the best, and we got the best. And we got Zweig. Our ops guy, Alan Black, he knew Zweig from the world of documentaries. Zweig was an oddball. He'd made a film about curmudgeons. He'd made a film about obsessive record collectors. He'd made a film about ex-cons. So he shuffled into our office one day, this Alan Zweig guy, gray, untucked. Looked kind of like Larry David, but without money. He pulled a crumpled list of ideas out of his pocket. This Zweig guy, he brought like a cloud of negativity in with him. But negative to what? Was he sour at us for daring to judge his ideas? Or was he negative towards himself for subjecting himself to our judgment? He was negative towards the ideas themselves. Each one he shit on himself after pitching it to us before we could even respond. It was like the whole pitching ritual, it was just a part of any creative business, was simultaneously beneath him and beyond him. And then we shook hands and he slouched away. And we looked at each other. Well, Julie Shapiro took a long pull on her cohiba, and she said, "Boys, I've been in the podcasting business since you were both using dial-up. I know it when I hear it. Ear Lawn had it. Roman Mars had it. And this guy Zweig, he's got it too." And we sat there like that, in a cloud of Shapiro's green-brown Cuban smoke. We let it all sink in. Alan Zweig, contemptuous of and disconnected from popular culture, hosting a celebrity interview podcast. It was the worst idea we'd heard. The worst podcast. "Shapiro," I said, "I'm in." "There's just one problem," said Black. "Zweig doesn't actually know what a podcast is. He literally will have no idea what he's doing." "Not yet," Shapiro said, That's why we need a guinea pig. I looked at Shapiro. I looked at Black. They were both looking at me. Wait for it.
Alan Zweig.
Yes.
Welcome to your podcast.
Thank you.
It's called The Worst Podcast. And you know what? This is our episode zero. This is sort of like the sneak peek into what the show is going to be like. And Jesse Brown, publisher at Canada Land, will be joining you to talk about the show.
Someday when this show doesn't go, this will be like in a blooper reel of this is how bad it was. Listen.
This will either be the very first thing on the feed for The Worst Podcast, or it will live in a Google Drive somewhere deep in the depths of the internet and never see the light of day.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know which one I wish.
We've just recorded our first, like, official episode. How are you feeling about the show so far?
I feel like, let's be honest, we're going to do four or five episodes, and you people are going to decide whether I'm going to do more. So if you decide I'll do more, then the next time I do one, it'll be a little easier because I'll be like, well, I don't know what the I was doing, but if that's good enough. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we did a second season, like on the 20th, I might not be nervous anymore.
Listen, Alan, you keep calling me you people. I'm Katie. I'm your producer. I have zero decision-making power here. Okay. I just do all of the edits. I'm here to have a nice time with you.
And so you're saying
say
you're slightly more on my side than their side.
Yeah, yeah. Their side being
those people.
I guess,
so from now on,
people.
I'll call them those people.
Those people. I'm just here to help you make the best possible product.
I'm sorry, I'm your friend, Alan. I'm sorry I tied you in with those people. Those people.
Okay, speaking of those people, I think we better bring Jesse Brown, publisher of Canada Land and head of Those People, in here to chat about the show.
Okay. Hello, Jesse Brown. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Alan.
So, okay, there's a few elephants in the rooms. Let's try to get rid of those. So, the name of the show.
Yeah.
So if I had a documentary called The Worst, nobody would say, hey, do you want to see The Worst documentary? They would just say, I really like this documentary. What's it called? The Worst. But with podcast, I feel like I can't say my podcast is called The Worst. I think it's just going to be natural that people are going to call it The Worst Podcast. Do you care? Does that matter? Is that good or bad? I can't tell.
You've lost me already.
Okay. How this happened that essentially you were part of a decision to give me a show on your precious little enclave is amazing to me because I don't get you at all. I don't mean, and that's not an insult. I don't get a lot of people.
There were like three insults in there. I was part of the decision. This doesn't happen without me making the decision.
Like that,
and then my precious little. It was actually elegant how many insults you fit into that.
That's not an insult. It's funny actually though. So on the way here, I was listening to one of your Canada Land episodes about a cult.
Yeah,
and I thought, do you ever have the thing like I do, like that person who's the cult leader is pretty dumb. Like, in this case, it was this Filipino woman who's the Queen of Canada.
Yes.
If she can get all these followers, how many could I get? Like, or I was thinking more for you. I think you are totally, totally lined up. You already have subscribers. You could turn those subscribers into cult members. You could marry all their wives.
The opposite is true. First of all, I'm the least adept or well-positioned or well-inclined person to be a cult leader. I've almost created the opposite. Like, if you think about what it is to be a Canada Land listener, what do they all say? They all say, I like it, except even with that Jesse Brown. They listen to it despite me.
You know what? You're making the bar way too high. Like, You are not as charismatic as Jim Jones, okay? But you're at least as charismatic as David Koresh.
You're a very confused man. Like, David Koresh had people who were willing to die for him. I have people who I pay money to who are not willing to be in a tweet with me. Okay. No one's dying for me. There is an idea that we are trying to get people. It's a very cerebral thing. It's like, I'm going to pay this guy to disagree with me and annoy me. Like, that's a hard service to provide. And it's kind of miraculous that we've gotten so many people to do it.
Okay, well, you're saying to the listeners, you might disagree with me, blah, 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 but I provide a service. What are you going to tell them about me? I provide nothing.
I don't think that's true.
What am I going to provide?
I think that what is incredibly refreshing in a world of automatic bullshit, bullshit by default. And if it's we're now so atomized that either people are just putting up a facade of very smiley bullshit, or it's this very strange, almost algorithmic rage. So it's a breath of fresh air, and it's worth its weight in gold to have a curmudgeon, to have negativity.
I'm not negative. I just want to point that out. I'm not negative.
You just negated me.
No, that's not negative. That's disagreeable. Maybe I'm disagreeable. Yeah, see, Jesse, I just
check your
again,
notes. Yeah.
In my notes, what are my favorite synonyms for negativity? Gloomy, defeatist, dismissive, bleak. I'm not bleak, but I like that. The one I like, I have a whole list here, but churlish. I don't know what that means, churlish.
I'm not sure if you're
churlish. My favorite one is dyspeptic.
Dyspeptic.
Now, it sounds in the stomach. It's very
gastro.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. In my film, I curmudgeon, I interviewed this guy that people in Toronto might know, Bill Grove. He was a jazz sax player. He's an iconoclast. He used to have a very popular jazz show on the Ryerson's to CKLN. And he said, and when he says this, he gets gales of laughter. But when I say you're negative, he said, I'm not negative. I'm just a really disappointed optimist. Mm-hmm. And I think that is sort of actually the most brilliant thing that I think is closer to me. If I was just disappointed in everything all the time, you know, I wouldn't even notice. It's all shit.
I mean, look at the effort that you're making and at your age.
At my age. That's the other thing. I did have the idea that the only reason you hired me is when I go down in flames, it will demonstrate why you've been ageist all this time. Look what happens when we get an old person.
You know, you say the meanest things. You say you're not a negative person.
I'm just, you know, whatever. I have to do this to defend myself. Because, like, first of all, you're big and you're hovering over me.
Don't be intimidated.
And also, I'm not intimidated, not the right word. More like, I don't trust you.
That's probably
totally
wise.
True.
Yeah.
Is
that the dominant feeling when you think of me, like distrust?
Well, it's because we had that first meeting where So I come in and I say, look, I hope I don't have to pitch you an idea. I think, like, maybe I'd be good at this. I hope that this not depend on me coming up with the killer podcast idea. And you said
you
nothing.
You hope that getting a podcast did not depend on you having a good idea for a podcast.
Well, is every one of your hosts came up with the idea themselves, or did you hire some hosts?
Yeah, a mix.
To me, this is that I'm even here is interesting to me because I don't even know how I ended up doing what I do in films. Like I didn't start off to do any of this, and I certainly didn't start off to be an interviewer, which is obvious because I'm not even letting you talk. So to me, it's just fascinating that I'm ending up like, is this going to work? Like, if this works, that'll be amazing. If it doesn't, I will walk away with my head held high.
I would go even further. I don't even think you know what this is.
No, I don't.
It's your show.
Well, that's, you know what, the thing, here's what I hope.
Okay.
My hope, my great hope. My great hope is that it could run for years and be successful, and at the end, I still wouldn't know. I think that's what you should hope, too. Because as soon as I start knowing, I think it'll suck. Like, I came in today with a script or something because Katie and I talked about it, but I suck with a script. I can't have a script.
Yeah.
I can't look at my notes. I don't know what I'm doing. What are we doing next? Oh, let me look at this page. Like, I can't do that. What am I supposed to ask him? Oh, what's the worst thing anyone ever said to you, Jesse?
What's the worst thing?
Well, it doesn't have to be the worst thing. Just tell me one bad thing somebody once said to you.
And here I wonder if the conceit of the show might be flawed, because who remembers? Like,
right.
It's a strange thing because we hold on to things that people say to us. But if you're, but it's not like mentioning my favorite album or something. Like, what's the worst thing?
I think the key conceit of this show is challenging. Oh, I know. I have a list of the worst things anybody ever said to you. Oh, yeah.
I feel like saying anything right now interrupts one of the greatest performances I've ever. I'm just curious
Thank
how
you.
Far you could go and how much.
Here's my
you could
here's
cover.
What my idea.
Yes.
Why don't we just call the show The Worst and then do whatever we're doing now?
This works for me. I mean, with a good edit.
Yeah. Thank God. Is it possible that this podcast is the worst idea you've ever had?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's good. That makes you feel better.
I mean, I wasn't lying when I said I was excited by it, but, I have no idea if it's going to work.
Do you feel more optimistic or less than you were an hour ago?
I feel more optimistic. Yeah. I feel like not everyone who sits across from you is going to be as familiar with the way that you talk and think as I am, because you are familiar to me. But I do think that anybody who sits across from you is going to have a reaction, is going to have a response to you. And I'm endlessly curious as to how people are going to react to you. I don't think I would have been excited about this if I just thought you were negative or a curmudgeon, because if you truly were negative, then what would the point be?
No, I'm not. I'm telling you that I'm a one-trick pony. I can only do what I do. And if you interfere with it with, like, give me some background or knowledge or tell me to do something or here's a question to ask, you just f*** me up.
Do you even listen to podcasts?
No, all the time.
What do you listen to?
You know, the podcast has become for me like streaming television. There's too many choices.
Mm-hmm.
And I listen to things for 5 minutes and I'm like, oh, no.
Who's your favorite podcast host?
I don't have one. I can't even say that. You know,
sometimes. Who do you aspire to emulate in the type of podcasting career that you're embarking upon now?
There's nobody. Here's the thing that worries me. I've listened to some okay podcasts, but they were also boring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I listened to it. It was okay, but it was boring. I'm not going to say I aspire to be Marc Maron, but I've heard some Marc Maron podcasts that were crackling. He did one with Paul Giamatti. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I like that you use the word crackling. I use that word a lot. That's when it's good. That's when it's got that energy. But you just reminded me, actually, of the moment during which I decided to go ahead with this project. And it was when we did a demo and you interviewed a young woman who was kind enough to come and donate some time to be your guinea pig. And I've never seen this happen before in an interview in my life. I've produced hundreds of interviews for other people, and this has never happened. I knew that we shared a value because it was your first time doing this. It was a strange format that was kind of thrust upon you. And you wouldn't let her leave.
She did say, haven't we been doing this long enough? Has it been an hour? Let me out of here.
She said, when can I leave? I've never heard, because if there is one lie common to every interview I've ever been a part of, or seen for that matter, it's so nice to be here. There's nowhere I'd rather. I'm here for as long as you want me. The only time when that's ever broken is when somebody gets offended and they just stand up and they throw their lapel mic down. And then that's a great moment. That's the one rare variation I've seen on the theme. But I've never, ever heard a guest say, how much longer is this going to be? When do I get to leave?
I'm not sure that that's a compliment to me.
No, but, I knew.
But I was in my
you
defense.
You don't understand. We were collaborating in that moment because I knew that you knew that this was going to be edited and you were not going to let this fail. And I think we recorded 2 hours, but you were going to get 20 good minutes.
It was an hour. But you know what? I'm going to be serious for a moment. Mm-hmm. I'm making my film now, and I'm making a film about a very sensitive subject. And people say things to you, and you can hear the next question, but you're like, can I even ask that? And my answer to all documentary filmmakers and kids listening, ask. Even I am embarrassed sometimes by my own questions, but you put that in the film and people are, their jaws are on the ground and you're like, that was the very last thing they said. In fact, I'll tell you one like weird thing. It turned into a trick, but I didn't mean it as a trick. When we're done, we have to get room tone. Mm-hmm. So I say, okay, we're done. Let's get room tone. Then everybody's quiet for 30 seconds. Then my crew knows, don't cut. And like between room tone and the next 5 minutes, when I say, okay, now we're really done, I could make 1,000 films from those 5 minutes.
My hope is that your natural curiosity about people and then something to do with whatever they make of you is going to result in who the hell knows what. But whatever it is, I'm hoping that it won't be like the same old I hear every day.
You're saying you can see how the show might work. I can see how it might work too. And also very clearly how it might not.
All right, that is episode zero of The Worst Podcast with Alan Zweig. Normally on the show, he's actually interviewing a notable person, a celebrity, and he got some. You know, Paul F. Tompkins, Mr. Peanut Butter from BoJack Horseman, he's on The Worst Podcast. Steph Tolev, amazing comedian, is on The Worst Podcast. Rick Moody, who wrote The Ice Storm. Ron McLean is interviewed on The Worst Podcast, one of the most fabulous drag queens in Canada. It goes on and on. It doesn't go on that much further than that, but it's all on The Worst Podcast, a show unlike anything that we've ever published, unlike anything you've ever heard.
At a certain point with my daughter, I realized we have no tools to force them to do anything.
My only leverage is I threaten to take away cookies.
In Whippy, I was the only brown person on my street. I came home crying one time. I was like, Mom, somebody called me brown. And she was like, you are brown. Now yeah. I bully all white people. So that's why I'm here today, to bully you.
Okay, well, if you do a good job,
you let me know.
I'll accept it. This is the worst one I've done. And with the best guests, the best guests so far, I've done the worst job.
Okay, that is your Canada Land show. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Today's show was produced by Katie Lauer and Kevin Sexton, and executive producer Julie Shapiro, commissioning producer Alan Black. Tristan Capicchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Max Collins is our production manager. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Karen Pugliese.
Jonathan Goldsby.
Yay! Editor-in-Chief of Canada Land, host and co-producer of Canada Land Back, and currently three time zones behind me. Today on the show, Q, are we not spies? A, we are Zevo. And as Newfoundland becomes the first province without a daily print newspaper in 120 years, maybe, we wonder, how do we keep talking shit about the news as there's less and less news about which to talk shit? Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we continue, for the time being and perhaps indefinitely, to talk shit about the news.
We're going to keep talking shit about the news.
Well, it's uncertain days for the province's only daily newspaper, The Telegram.
Major staff cuts are coming to The Telegram newspaper as Post Media turns the print edition into a weekly.
I find that quite concerning. We're definitely in an era where we need more information, more accurate, you know, verifiable, you know, journalist-produced information and not less.
You just keep on cutting and cutting, then you have less product and people stop consuming it because, you know, there's less there for them to buy. It's a brutal way to go.
So Post Media's effort to acquire the newspapers from the distressed Sawyer chain was ultimately successful. We talked about this a bit on the show a few weeks ago, back when it was first announced slash proposed, but it's gone through. The deal is closed. They have assumed control of the Sawyer papers in Atlantic Canada, notably the Chronicle Herald in Halifax, as well as the Telegram in St. John's. And not terribly surprisingly, one of the first things they've done is basically end its life as a daily newspaper. It will now publish in print once a week without having spent any time in Newfoundland. I can't speak directly to what that actually means on a day-to-day basis for people in St. John's and environs. But trying to figure out, like, what does this mean in the context of Canadian history? Like, when has this happened before, that there has been a Canadian province that has not had a daily newspaper since basically Canada, you know, obviously Canada in the modern sense of the modern state, 1867, and then provinces gradually joined after. That was roughly the era when daily newspapers became a thing, when newspapers are shifting from weekly or biweekly to dailies. And so as far as I can tell from by spending too many hours on many provincial archive websites, the last time there was a Canadian province that did not have a daily newspaper may have been a 2.5 month period in the late summer, early fall of 1905.
Wow.
So Saskatchewan became a province in September 1st, 1905. And then about mid-November, the Regina Leader switched from a weekly to a daily. As far as I could determine, that was the last time that a province, well, you know, had at least a few months of the province, no newspaper. And then before that, you have to go back another, it seems like you have to go back at least another couple of decades. Like,
well, you know, you're getting to Confederation, so.
I'll read a bit from the story that they had on the front page of the Telegram itself by Juanita Mercer. It's mid-morning in the Telegram newsroom. The sound of reporters tap, tap, tapping on their keyboards fills the air and light pours in from the huge windows. The sunlight shines on the brown wooden tabletop behind me where we've held so many story meetings. What will happen to that table? I find myself wondering aloud. Around it, reporters sat on half-broken chairs every morning, germinating the seeds of some of this province's biggest stories. Around it, editors huddled every afternoon to lay out the next day's paper. That's all history now. Friday morning was our last meeting around that table. Everyone will work from home now. After a 145-year run, this paper that stretched out between your hands is the last daily printed Telegram. The People's Paper is now fully embracing that fast-paced world of online daily news where stories are quickly accessed with the tap of a smartphone screen. They say that's how a new generation of readers prefers to navigate their busy lives. So, goodness knows we've talked endlessly about the decline/death of media, what happens next, and all of that endlessly on this show and our other shows. And I guess that one of the things I'm also reflecting as after having done Shortcuts now for 2.5 years and having reported on media and had media as a beat for many years before that, both at Canada Land and previously, what does happen as we move into an age where we're not talking shit about the news any less, but there's less news about which to talk shit? I mean, as long as there is media or communication in some form, it'll be possible to have a meta conversation around it. I'm not worried about that. What I'm wondering is, have we already or are we about to tilt into a place where there is more meta conversation than there actually is news.
We're already there. The number of podcasts that are just kind of rip and read or TikTok. I'm spending a lot of time on TikTok recently because I'm liking seeing the discussion around the American election through TikTok, but a lot of what they're saying is not accurate. Like, we go through a fact-checking process on the show after we record, and we look and make sure that we've got things right.
Yeah, it's not an infallible one, but we definitely put the work in.
Yeah, we put the work in, and we correct if we get something wrong. There's also opinions, and opinions are fine, as long as it's based on some facts, you know. But I guess where I'm going with this is that I hear a lot of people just get basic facts wrong when they're describing, like, one of the big ones has been the Liberals. Carbon pricing has been a big one where everybody who's discussing it seems to get little elements of it wrong. And then, you know, it's almost like a telephone game. And it's really problematic because you're basing things not off original reporting. And there's a lot of speculation and there's mistakes being made with the facts because not everybody who's doing this work is following like a rigorous journalistic policy or rigorous fact-checking process.
Yeah, it's not even so much a kids these days thing as that now there are just generally more opportunities to have or create things that engage with or deploy certain tropes of news or certain tropes of journalism or certain tropes mm-hmm. of conventional media without actually having necessarily the resources or rigor underneath it to actually create the structures upon which to build the commentary. Or it's not a generational thing so much as just a platform thing. And the idea of, like, well, on the one hand, democratization of media, yay, but on the other hand, well, I mean, we've seen where that is getting us. I mean, like, Twitter was and can still be an immensely useful and valuable thing because it basically Twitter is largely, I mean, there is a lot of enormous amount of original reporting, but it's also brought by and large sort of this ongoing, ever rolling meta conversation about the news, about information, about how information is reported, how it comes out, and I mean the commentary on it, of course, but also just pointing out the things that sort of fall between the stories, between the lines. I mean, it is media criticism, and it can and often has been very valuable media criticism. And I feel like Shortcuts originally, and it was intended almost as an extension of that, of sort of how do you bring the Twitter conversations, or at least the better ones, to an audience that may not necessarily actually be on Twitter. So how do you sort of explain the kinds of discussions, the worthwhile discussions that are or often have been taking place there and use those as sort of jumping off points for conversations? And I think that's really good and really valuable. But I think the question now is, first of all, is there's less news than ever, but as Twitter is also
more garbage than ever.
More garbage than ever and has been redesigned in a way that to deliberately lean into the meta conversation.
It leans into polarization.
Basically, we have all the voices that we had that we previously had on Twitter, but less of the actual information underpinning it. The non-information, the worst shit is elevated.
What's happening in the industry, if we look at this as the, you know, what's the problem to solve, is there was a world in which we created media that was not a product, but a service. And it operated and people bought it and engaged with it because they trusted it as a source of information that was more trustworthy than government, because government was just going to sell them some policies or, you know, try to spin them. So in the ideal world of legacy media, when it all works correctly, you've got people who are working for the reader. And when that strays from its mandate, it became something to critique. It would be shocking. It would be scandalous. What's happened with the evolution of journalism is that the worst stuff rises to the top.
And where actual news is banned outright.
Yeah, or where actual news is now banned outright. That's right. It's like I'm still living in a world where I imagine that there's news on Meta. But, you know, also when I'm watching and I'm thinking about these new platforms, you have to say, well, why are people getting into them? Like, some people are like getting in as good faith actors who want to have a valuable discussion that belongs in democracy. And other people are getting in and they have a right to do this simply to monetize. I watch some of the TikTokers and they're sitting there, they're talking to somebody and then they'll interrupt and go, "Ooh, I just got a rose. I just got $5. I just got $5. It feels like a little bit of a pay for play. Are the motives just to shock, to get more people engaged and paying, like the public service element is not what's motivating it, I guess. And so there's not the motivation to be accurate or to be honest if your motivation is just to get the next $5. Clearly, we all want to pay paid for our job. But like I said, there was a world in which we had even decided in journalism that sometimes we would cover stories that were going to be unpopular. I've done that here at Candleland, where I've chosen stories that I know maybe aren't going to get the most clicks, but are going to have great service. Indigenous stories don't get as many clicks as non-Indigenous stories. They just don't. But that doesn't mean that you don't do them. But if I was completely motivated by my bottom line, you know, I wouldn't be able to do those stories. I'd be doing Sex and Kittens because that's what sells. Like, it's a great opportunity to have all this media where all these voices are moving in. But where's the anchor now for the reason why we create journalism? And I actually think that we need this show more than ever.
Maybe the reason I'm bringing this up at all, for a show that for most of its life had, for the first 10 years was or is like a reflection or extension of Twitter discourse. And now that I'm about to, you know, take at least 8 months off of it, where's editor-in-chief? Do you see this show going from here?
You know what, Jonathan? If I've heard anything over the past couple of months that I've been here from our listeners, I just have gotten hundreds of emails of people telling us they want media criticism. And Candleland can be proud. Like, it was one of the first places that had professional journalists come in and go on the record and talk about what was happening behind the scenes, behind the walls, inside newsrooms. And that was not easy to do. It broke the silence, I guess, here, and made open discussions of what's happening inside newsrooms something that journalists could do. And I think that's that transparency is so important for the public, particularly in times like now when things are being cut. How do you do an investigation at CTV or at Global when most of your investigative journalists have been laid off? That great talk that we had with Justin Lang when he was telling us that scrums don't really happen up on the Hill anymore. People are writing off of press releases. People are writing from their homes and not getting out into spaces where they actually see what's going on. Those are all incredibly important things to know about what's happening inside newsrooms right now.
Yeah, the criticizing is the usually the fun and the easy part, the calling out bad. But the act of explaining, of criticism, less in the sense of like, oh, is this a, you know, a thumbs up or thumbs down or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 star review, and criticism in the sense of like, oh, this will be a thoughtful, earnest effort to explain and explore why something works or doesn't, and just trying to basically enlighten people to the techniques and mechanisms that are working under the surface that brought you this product overall.
Yeah, pulling back the curtain and showing people how stories get made. I mean, there's room for public education. There's room for us to also look at disinformation, to look at how journalism is operating in the new world, even if it is via, you know, TikTok, or how the platforms are working to suppress some points of view and elevate other points of view. Those are all things that we have to talk about, because our media world right now has really shifted. And so the critique of it is going to shift. It's got to be a serious critique. Like, we've got to take what we do seriously. And I've heard a lot from the audience that they really want that journalistic critique.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to listening. Karen, as you know as well as, if not better than anyone on this show, we like to duly note things.
I love duly noting things.
Yes, what would you like to note duly today?
I have the painful pleasure of duly noting that a certain colleague of mine who happens to be on the show right now is the proud recipient of a Massey Fellowship. Congratulations, Jonathan Goldsby.
Yes, I was deducing that. I think I'm the only colleague of yours who's on the show right now. I mean, yes, James is lurking in the background, but yes, this is the first to me. And thank you. Yes, I'm one of the William Southern Journalism Fellows for the coming 2024-25 academic year. And so I'll be taking an 8-month sabbatical or break from Candleland to take a bunch of courses in whatever subjects I want.
These fellowships are like awesome, and it's such a great opportunity. But for now, I just want to say congratulations. It'll be a hard 8 months without you, but I'm so happy for you that you're getting this opportunity. It's great.
Duly noted. And I would like to note duly Kevin O'Keefe, who is actually sitting to my left in the studio right now and who will be effectively filling in for me for the next 8 months. He's a refugee from W5 and was previously at Extra, where he worked with Archie. Extra being having formerly been branded as Canada's Gay and Lesbian News. I can't remember what tagline they use now, but it's more broadly, it's now an online queer publication. But I also, but I look at it particularly duly note that he is not the Kevin O'Keefe who writes the Drag Race recaps for Extra. That is a different person named Kevin O'Keefe who has a second F in O'Keefe. And so if you have strong opinions about Kevin O'Keefe's Drag Race hot takes, this is not the Kevin O'Keefe to whom to direct those.
Okay, well, there's a Kevin O'Keefe apparently with two Fs and a Kevin O'Keefe that has one F. We have the Kevin O'Keefe with one F.
We have the one F.
Make of that what you will.
I find the two Fs very pretentious, so I'm glad I only have one F. And I'm recording this conversation. I was going to submit it to CSIS, but I guess that's not a good idea, so I won't do that.
Great to have you here, Kevin.
Duly noted.
Karen, are you familiar with the website TV Tropes? I think we need a new trope that I was surprised didn't exist called overeager narc. A sort of person who perhaps enthusiastically volunteers or offers to wear wire on behalf of the state.
I know where this one's going.
Well, I hope so, since you know what we're talking about today. So now to switch gears, are you familiar with Adam Zivo?
Yes, I am familiar with Adam Zivo, a columnist from the National Post. Mm-hmm. His background, I believe, was in film. He did some commercial work. He did some artistic kind of videos. I actually thought he was quite good at them. Zivo covered a lot of stories that were involving LGBTQ2S. Very different from what he's doing in the National Post, though.
He started writing for the Post in early 2021 as a contributing columnist. Early columns are what I would describe as maybe relatively generic moderate conservative. And as he, you know, contributed more and more frequently over the next few years, I would say that like conservatism more generally, he pretty much shifted into culture war conservatism. He is best known, both probably most highly regarded and reviled, for his coverage of Safe Supply, which he is extremely critical. And his, you know, writing on that is a coverage of that has ended up influencing policy in Safe Supply across Canada.
It absolutely has. He has met with Pierre Poilievre, and Pierre Poilievre frequently quotes him. Yeah.
We're not actually going to talk about the Safe Supply coverage today. Jesse has touched on that in the show many times before. I believe the backbench has touched on that. Today, we're going to talk about Ukraine. So in early 2022, after Russia invaded Ukraine, Zivo went over there to cover it. He didn't really have any prior conflict reporting experience that I'm aware of. He had limited journalism experience, but, you know, certainly a bold thing to do. But it's not unheard of for journalists, including many respected journalists, to have gotten their start by taking similar risks, putting themselves into a conflict zone.
It is actually a crazy thing that young journalists do. And he's not the only person with no war zone experience that I saw pop over to the Ukraine during that period.
He filed for the Post from there for, you know, on and off throughout 2022, a little bit in 2023. But just the past couple weeks, we've learned about something else he got up to in Ukraine while he was there. At the same time, he was freelancing, covering it for the Post. This started actually with a tweet from, or an ex-post from CSIS from August 8th. I mean, it's weird that the spy agency is tweeting anyway, but like, here's what they said. Has a stranger ever tried to inflate your ego? It could be elicitation. Elicitation is a set of techniques used by foreign agents to extract information from you. To learn the warning signs of elicitation, read the CSIS Travel Security Guide. Yes, I'm sure everyone will do that. And so he responded to that saying, well, people are dunking on this tweet, but this actually happened to me in Odessa in early 2023 with a guy who seemed to be a Chinese spy. I ended up organizing a small sting operation with two Ukrainian intelligence officers to figure out what his deal was. So that raises a lot of questions.
Oh, yeah, it does.
And he later expanded on that in one very, very, very long post. And then he further elaborated on it in an article or an interview with Luc Lebrun for Press Progress. And then Zivo has also filled in for Alex Pearson on Global News Radio sometimes. And around the time that Luc Lebrun started to ask questions about this, he also went on the radio show and gave this maybe basically a 20-minute explanation, good thing to fill airtime, of what happened. That hasn't been posted online, but Luc happened to record it live and has been kindly shared that with us.
I look over and I see this, you know, Chinese Chinese guy. I'm going to give him the pseudonym of Bao. And he was speaking English loudly. And I was like, okay, I'm very interested in understanding minority experiences in Ukraine. I've written quite a bit about that, whether it be LGBTQ Ukrainians or African refugees in Ukraine. And I go and I say hi to him. And I think this guy could be a friend. And he introduces himself as Bao. I say, hey, I'm a Canadian journalist. And he says, oh, he's had a lot of experience in Canada, too. He immediately procures in Ontario's driver's license. And I was like, okay, well, that's interesting. And I think to myself, I really want to understand this guy's story. Because, I mean, with any journalist, you are always looking for something interesting.
Yeah, so he met this guy and they tried to get together for drinks. And then he started to have sort of weird feelings about him. Leo is Zeebo's boyfriend.
And as we're taking the taxi away, Leo says, I don't like that guy. He seems kind of greasy. And he was kind of greasy. You know, he had like tattoos. He was saying bro a lot. His whole vibe was a little bit off.
So he starts digging online, Googling this guy. And they're definitely, I mean, if Zeebo is accurately describing this, like there definitely are questions. It's definitely the sort of thing with where as a journalist, you're like, oh, this is raising lots of questions about who is this guy? What is his deal? Why does he seem to have photos on his Instagram that are actually, you know, sourced from TripAdvisor? Like he wasn't actually at a hotel in Ottawa, but just using a, you know, posing a photo from TripAdvisor on his Instagram page.
Oh, okay. That's a little weird.
Why has he spent time in Canada, in Belarus, in China?
We find out that, you know, the guy attended an elite middle school in the UK for when he was like 12, 13 years old. And then he went to high school in Ottawa that actually seemed legit. And then afterwards, he went to go study Russian and diplomacy at the State University of Belarus.
And he becomes convinced, essentially, that Bao is, in fact, a Chinese and or Russian spy, or perhaps involved with both. He indicates like, well, maybe you would write about this at some point, but he considers this like an imminent threat. He comes under the impression that they were trying to maybe kidnap him. And so he tries to loop in the authorities. His evidence for all of that I would describe as fairly circumstantial at best.
I actually really like the way that Press Progress described it. They called it dramatic and fantastical.
Dramatic and fantastical, that's exactly it. And so when he relayed this on the radio, he opened the first segment with the James Bond theme and the second segment with the Get Smart theme. And he does have a sense of humor about it. He said it's, I think, less James Bond and more Mr. Bean. And as I was going through this and you know, poring over TV tropes and talking to people, what does this remind me of? The consensus seems to be Dwight Schrute, the character from The Office, played by Rainn Wilson.
How do we get to Dwight Schrute?
I actually haven't seen The Office beyond the... I've seen The British one. I haven't seen The Office beyond the first season, but I'm certainly familiar enough with it. And it's not hard to find appropriate clip.
Oscar visited Mexico when he was 5 to attend his great-grandmother's funeral. What does that mean to a United States law enforcement officer? He's a potential drug mule.
That's right. I forgot. It's been forever since I've seen The Office. I forgot how obsessed that character was with being a spy or working for the government. Okay, yes.
So he really wants to bring this to the attention of the authorities.
So I took everything that I saw, all the information that I had, these weird interactions, and I wrote this really long report about it. And then I tried to submit it to CSIS. And then I spoke for an hour on the phone with CSIS being like, by the way, this is what happened. Are you going to do anything? Can you keep me safe? Are you going to warn other journalists? And, you know, the guy seemed like just really unengaged with his job. And then he's like, yeah, you know, we don't accept PDFs. I made this report so beautiful. It was full of screenshots, references. Explaining what happened.
We don't accept PDFs.
Yeah, so then I had to like submit it in the text box and I had to do like 10 different submissions because the report was so thorough.
Can we just like say that if he really wanted to bring it to the attention of the authorities, the normal way that a journalist would do that is they write about it.
Yes,
they would
exactly.
publish it.
And that's the thing is I feel like you and I've had lots of debates and discussions about advocacy journalism and what is advocacy journalism. But I feel like I don't think that and this isn't, but I do feel like it's okay to practice advocacy as a journalist so long as the advocacy is conducted fully through the work
yes.
transparently itself, so long as everything is being conducted fully in public via the work.
But this is next level.
But this is not via the work, right? This is the exact opposite.
You and I have been working like with the team at Candleland on creating a JSP, and I didn't think I had to write in it if you come across something that's very newsy, don't go running to CSIS behind the scenes. Just publish the damn thing.
He doesn't really get anywhere with that. Then he essentially tries to get the attention of the Ukrainian authorities. He doesn't really seem to know how to get in touch with them, as they, perhaps they don't have an English language web form. But he basically goes and finds people at like a checkpoint and tries to use Google Translate, tries to convey it to them. Doesn't really, having a hard time conveying what he's trying to convey. Eventually, using Google Translate and then I think some Duolingo, manages to be connected with people who will at least listen to him and hear him out.
And then at the end of it, they're like, yeah, you know what, this sounds pretty concerning. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And they said, well, we don't have enough information. Well, that wasn't going to cut it for me because I wanted to make sure that I was safe. So I said, hey, like, I'm a filmmaker. I have a microphone with me that I can just tape on. Why don't we just like go for dinner and then I'll just record him and then we'll see what happens. They said, okay. They're like, are you sure? Do you feel safe with that? And I said, yeah, you know what? I would feel safer knowing what's happening around me than just leaving this guy around in the city, you know, to do whatever with. I have dinner with this guy. Bao brings his wife, who's half Chinese, half Ukrainian. You know, her name is Yulia, another pseudonym we're going to give them. And like their story is full of holes. You know, they really can't explain.
Ooh, do they seem married? Or does it look like they're Mr. and Mrs. Smith? Like no,
they're
posing.
There's no love. There's no love.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Right. All right. There you go. The signs still once again.
Yeah. And like, he mentions that he loves Eastern Europe. I ask him, well, where have you been? He mentions every country except for Belarus. I ask him, you know, did you formally study Russian? He says no. Even though on his LinkedIn, he says he formally studies Russian. He says that he moved to Ukraine in like August of 2022 to expand his tire business. And I was like, okay, sure.
And that's basically it, except he later learned or had reason to believe the guy and his wife basically decamped to Belgium afterward and takes that as a further sign that something was indeed amiss. And this is the point where, like in a fictional narrative, there would be something that would be shown, probably not necessarily to the characters, but certainly to the audience, that would show, you know, that would indicate that, oh, the protagonist was actually onto something all along, whether or not they actually were able to obtain justice for it or get people's attention. Their hunch was actually borne out or had reason to believe it. But this is real life.
In a drama, it would be borne out. And in a comedy, you would find out that the guy is like actually, you know, just a regular guy.
Yeah.
It could go either way. We don't know if this is a drama or a comedy yet.
No, and I don't think, I think we pretty much know it's a comedy. I think Zevo knows it's a comedy, but we also don't know what the resolution is because I don't think when you actually look at it, and like I think they're presuming he's accurately conveying this, there's reason to believe this person was sketchy and there are at least questions worth Googling, but to actually feel like, oh, I caught this spy or at least I did my duty. So yeah, and kind of sort of an ethical no-no, generally speaking. Press Progress, you know, canvassed various experts in journalism ethics, including a few who I believe are your friends, Karen, one of whom is Sonia Fata of Toronto Metropolitan University, and definitely expressed with this the concerns you would imagine about, like, this is not something that journalists would generally do, and potentially this could endanger journalists.
That's a big one. This actually has like a bit of a serious turn to it, because one of the reasons that journalists don't easily cooperate with authorities is exactly that. Like we've talked about it in terms of actually being out at protests and land back movements inside Canada, that if people think that you're gathering evidence for the police, a good example of this happened at APTN where we're out at Rexton. And the RCMP wanted our tapes, and we said no when we were back and forth with them because somebody had burnt some police cars out there. Now, one, we didn't have evidence of it on tape anyway. But two, just the process of handing our tapes over to the police are going to make people think, well, those reporters just go out and gather tape for the police, and you don't want to be putting your people in places that are at risk. Sometimes some of the protests at the convoy where they weren't very appreciative of journalists from particularly mainstream news when I was working there, some of the journalists had things thrown at them, bricks thrown at them, you know, like it can get dangerous. And so when you're going out into a war zone and you're starting to spy on people for spy agencies, anybody out there working in the field, like soldiers, whatever, are going to lose their trust in journalists, can turn on journalists, can believe that you're spying for the other side. Like, this is not good stuff.
fascinating. He wasn't even the first person to have seemingly acted as a spy or done spycraft while working as a contributing columnist for the National Post. Vivian Berkovici, who was one of the ambassadors to Israel under Stephen Harper and who's been a Post columnist since 2017 or so, in 2021, Radio Canada reported or obtained evidence, strong indications that she actually was working for Black Cube, which is the sort of Israeli mercenary private spy company famous for the Harvey Weinstein stuff. And her work there was at least circa 2019 from the evidence they had, where she was sort of, they seemed to have emails where she was soliciting business. Anyway, yeah, that is, she's still a Post columnist.
Majoshin, Jonathan Goldsby. There's no word for goodbye in the Algonquin language. Oh. We say Majoshin, which means good journeys. Because we always presume we're going to see you again. I look forward to seeing you again in 8 months.
Yes, that's hopefully we'll see each other sooner. But yes, that is a very good, perfect word. Thank you for introducing that concept to me. That Shortcuts this week. Thanks for joining me, Karen.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So listeners can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. I believe the email address will remain active, and I will continue to read it. Karen, where can people find you?
Oh, you know, they can find me at Karen with a Y at canadaland.com.
Cool. And this episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins. Our editor-in-chief is you, Karen. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Who's some new?